Hey, everybody. Welcome to Movie Crush. Charles W. Chuck Bryant here, our home studio, Pond City Market, Atlanta. And I had a great conversation this week with John Convertino, my first drummer, a drummer for one of my favorite bands, Calexico. I've been a big fan of these dudes for a long time, kind of since the beginning. And if you do not know Calexico, then you should. They've been around for quite a while now and have a great body of work. And I talked to John a little bit about this at the beginning, but go check out any Calexico album. I mean, Carried to Dust about 8 years ago was a wonderful album. One of their first ones, The Black Light, classic album. Their more recent ones, Algiers, Edge of the Sun is wonderful. Feast of Wire, my God, what a classic. And then their new album out this year, The Thread That Keeps Us, is a really, really good record, like all Calexico albums. You can't go wrong. Give it a try if you've never listened to it. Calexico, if I were to describe them, they've been called desert noir, which is an interesting way to put it. They incorporate the sounds of the world, mainly south of the border of Mexico. They have trumpets, they have accordion, but it's all based around the songwriting of John Convertino and lead singer and guitar player Joey Burns, who are the co-founders of the band. And kind of worked with different dudes over the years, but they've had a solid band in place for a while now. And it's a very international band. I think their lead guitar player is from Spain. One of their trumpet players is German. They have another trumpet player from Mexico. And it's just a really, like I told them after the show, the crowd that leaves a Calexico show is not the crowd that shows up at a Calexico show. They get a crowd going like no band I've ever seen. So really, really good stuff. Check it out. John picked the movie Rumblefish, Francis Ford Coppola's classic follow-up to The Outsiders, what he called an art film for teenagers. And we had a really great conversation about life and music and the career that he's had, as well as how movies have figured in. They've done some scoring and soundtrack work, so it's kind of cool to get that perspective. He's a big movie fan, big Francis Ford Coppola fan. And it turns out he's a really nice guy because I don't know him at all. And he came in here from being on the road all night, overnight from New Orleans after a really late night jamming with the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. Tells me that story. That's off the charts. And a big thanks to Martin, Laura, and Michelle from their team for helping to put this together. John couldn't have been a nicer guy. And I ended up going to the show that night as well. So I'll cover a bit of that in the outro. But here we go with John Convertino of Calexico on Rumblefish. Well, I'm glad you came in, man. I've been such a fan for so long, since the very beginning. I've been on the Calexico train.
Oh, thank you.
So it's just really cool to see that you guys are still at it. And like, I was thinking last night, I was listening to the new record, which I'd like to talk a little bit about too. Okay. This isn't just about movies, but like you're at the point in your career now where like you have a body of work, and that phrase has some weight to it when you really think about it. Because, you know, I went to search through like what to play, and there's a lot to choose from now. It's not it's not an easy decision like it was in the mid 90s or the late 90s. I was like, oh, well, I'll play this one or that one. So it's just, I wonder what that feels like to have a bit of a perspective on that now.
Well, I think for the new record, I went back and listened to The Black Light, because it's coming
Such
on
its great
20th anniversary.
Oh my God. That's
so
crazy.
20 years ago. And it was really fun to listen to it because I think when you have 20 years, you know, space between the time you did it and the time you're listening to it, it almost feels like someone else had done it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? In a way. And I could be more, objective,
right?
Just like almost reading a book for the first time or something. I could listen to it for the first time and with those kinds of ears. And I have to say, I really enjoyed it.
I really did.
I was like,
so good.
Wow, I like the way the lyrics tell a story, and it's also musically really telling a story.
Yeah.
And I think it relates somewhat to what we're going to talk about later with Rumblefish, and
right.
that it has that kind of black and white feel to it, mm-hmm. that kind of noir, kind of, I hate to, I mean, using the word classic is makes it like I'm blowing my own horn, but it does, there's something about it that says, this is still okay. I mean, mm-hmm. It's not dated in
no,
that way.
There is a timeless, and you guys always have had a very cinematic quality to your music. So it comes as no surprise probably for the listeners that you guys have done music scores and and stuff like that.
Yeah, the song Frontera was originally, you know, it's just it's an instrumental, but we've been playing it for years now with this other song, Trigger, on top of it.
Yeah.
Joey singing the lyrics of Trigger on top of Frontera. So it was really refreshing to hear Frontera again as a complete and total instrumental.
Yeah.
And just stuff like that. And
I always appreciate that you guys still do instrumentals.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
Yeah. And I think, too, just having all those songs to choose from, it makes for touring is really just as interesting as it always has been, because we can always pull an old song out that we've maybe never played.
Yeah, that's probably pretty neat.
And like Slag off of our very first record, Spoke.
Uh-huh.
We never played it live before. And,
are you doing that now?
And we've been doing it. Yeah, we've been doing it over in Europe. And just little things like that. It's great to pull those songs out that you would never think that you would play live and
that's
give them
cool
a try.
For you guys, I'm sure, but it's that's the shit that fans love.
Yeah, I think
like,
so.
Because Calexico fans go deep, I imagine, like I do. And when you hear those deep cuts like that as a fan, it's like, that's the special stuff.
Well,
I mean,
you
all want to hear the hits.
Of course, yeah.
But, you know, you don't, it's not like you're not one of those bands that you bought the single of or whatever.
Right.
You know, they're complete albums. They always felt like they had a through line.
Yeah. It's funny how that song, Huero Canelo, kind of turned into a hit, and it was just a total throw off on the record.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Just kind of piecing together these, this groove, and Joey just kind of semi-rapping over and super distorted vocal.
Uh-huh.
But it just turned into this kind of monster song at the end of the night that we kind of can't not play anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it's just so much fun, you know, it's just,
yeah.
And everyone,
did you guys
leaves.
License that or?
Yeah, we did.
I've heard it before and something.
Yeah. And Collateral, the movie Collateral.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And we're actually in the movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah. For about 2 seconds. Took 3 days of shooting.
I don't remember. Were you the house band or something?
The house band. Yeah. When, Jamie Foxx is walking into the bar in LA.
Oh, yeah.
And that's when the song Huero Canelo is being played. Uh-huh. And you can see us in the background for a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And then supposedly during the dialogue scene, while they're in the club, the director, Michael Mann, had us playing while they were doing the dialogue. So we were having to pantomime. And the dancers had to dance with their shoes off.
Yeah.
Everything had to be totally silent.
No, it's always so weird.
Just in case you could see us in the reflection.
Right.
In one of the mirrors
or
something in the club. That's how precise that guy is.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah. And, you know, they were like long takes. Probably 12-hour takes.
Yeah.
You know,
that's no fun.
12-hour days.
For a band, because you're probably not used to that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
A little bit on music videos.
It was kind of fun. It was fun to meet Jamie Foxx. And,
and
it was fun to be on a Hollywood set.
Uh-huh.
But it did get a little grueling there after a while. I felt more for the dancers that had to look like they were having a great time dancing, and the cameras in the next room.
Uh-huh. You're like, is this really that important? What about working with Todd Haynes?
Oh, man.
On I'm Not There. I mean, it was such a great movie, and he's one of my favorite filmmakers. And what was that process like?
Well, he was super nice, like a brother.
Oh,
as
really?
Soon as he met us, he was just like, you know, he's like a fan, and he's super enthusiastic. And he loved the way the song turned out.
Yeah.
And it was the second day of shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the first day they had a pretty major disaster. Richard Gere was on a horse and the horse took off through the woods with him on it.
Oh, no. Something tells me Richard Gere is not a skilled,
well,
rider.
You know, it's not always, I mean, I think he is a pretty good rider, but sometimes a horse will just.
Yeah. They have their own ideas.
Sometimes.
Uh-huh.
And so he was a little shaken by that.
Oh, wow.
But but it was a really, really cool scene.
Yeah.
And an amazing project to be a part of.
Yeah, working with Jim James, of course, for
that
the listeners.
That was great. And just, I mean, we worked on a lot of songs for the movie that didn't get in the movie.
Uh-huh.
You know, Willie Nelson and Serge Gainsbourg, Charlotte Gainsbourg.
Yeah.
You know, just, and they weren't all, you know, in the same room with us.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times we were doing transferring files, but still, you know, to lay down a basic track and hear, I'm trying to think of his name from the Birds.
Roger McGuinn?
Yeah, I'm Roger McGuinn,
yeah,
singing over a track that we
That's
did.
Pretty cool.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, and you guys are known, I think, for collaborating.
Mm-hmm.
On your records and on other people's records. And I guess once you sort of get that reputation, that's, mm-hmm. It's a cool thing. You know, the phone probably brings a lot, I imagine.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's kind of, they always kind of work out, you mm-hmm. know, it's not like a ton of calls, which I don't think we could handle because we're on the road a lot.
Yeah.
But it seems like they've been spaced out enough to where we've been able to do these things.
Yeah, that's
it's been really, really fortunate for us.
Yeah.
Because as you know, it's harder to sell records
mm-hmm.
and CDs these days.
Right.
So if you can get soundtrack work,
yeah,
it's nice work if you can get it.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I think a lot of people are kind of trying to get that more
mm-hmm.
because it is good exposure.
Yeah.
But more than that, it's just a lot of fun to do, you know, because you have... You have a certain direction,
mm-hmm.
you know, you have a scene to write to.
Yeah, that's got to be a different kind of songwriting scenario for you guys.
Absolutely, yeah.
One of my favorite soundtracks is, or favorite scores, I guess, was Neil Young's Dead Man score for the great Jim Jarmusch movie.
Yeah.
I put that one on the other day, and it had been quite a few years since I'd listened to it. I wore it out at the time,
because
mm-hmm. I took a out west trip with a friend in the van for 2 months, and it was kind of right when that came out.
Nice.
So that was, you know, that was kind of our soundtrack of our trip.
That's great.
But something so simple, you know, just that one sort of lick he does on the guitar.
I know.
Was all he needed
to
really fill that thing out.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, that's the beauty of it, keeping it simple.
Mm-hmm.
And I love Jim Jarmusch. And once again, you know, you have black and white.
Mm-hmm.
He films in black and white a lot. And that's what I loved about Rumblefish, too. You know, it just, that timeless quality.
Yeah, Rumble. Well, we can go ahead and get into Rumblefish some, although we'll dance around with some other questions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Directed by Francis Ford Coppola, of course, 1983.
Mm-hmm.
His second film adaptation of an S.E. Hinton. I guess, I don't even know, they called them young adult novels back then. Mm-hmm. Maybe they did, but that's what you would call it now.
Yeah.
But he shot it right after The Outsiders,
mm-hmm.
kind of on the heels of that,
mm-hmm.
and kept that black and white, but it's still set in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
which is hard to sort of wrap your head around at first
right.
when you see the first 80s car go by.
Yeah.
Or there's the one scene where they're playing Pac-Man.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
it very much feels like a you know, 50s or 60s movie.
Right. Right.
And it's sort of a weird sleight of hand he played there.
I love that.
Yeah.
I really do. And because now, 20 years later, once again, mm. or 30 years later, excuse me, I was 20 years old when I watched it. That's
right.
where I got that. So, so you see that and you see how different the world looked, mm-hmm. even in the 80s from now.
And you have a Tulsa connection, right?
Absolutely. I think that's probably the main reason why I chose the movies, because we had just played in Tulsa.
Uh-huh.
And the gig was...
At Cane's?
No, it wasn't at Cane's. We have played there before. But growing up in Tulsa, I would hear about the Cane's, like a lot of the bigger punk rock bands were coming through at the time. You know, the Talking Heads, for example, in the uh-huh. late 70s. And... I remember even hearing that the Clash played there and wanting to go, but, you know, being underage, I couldn't.
Right. So you lived in Tulsa?
Lived in Tulsa, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I actually had a lot of freedom there because my parents divorced. I was the youngest. I was the only one who stayed with my dad, who stayed in Tulsa. And he was a musician.
What did he do?
He was a pianist. And he also worked at a music store. So he'd work all day at this music store. And he'd come home, we'd have dinner together, and then he'd go out and play at the Summit Club in Tulsa, which was on the top of, I think, one of the big bank buildings. It's this really swank club up there run by these Italian guys. And
are you Italian?
Yeah, my father was first generation.
Oh, cool.
And so, you know, he would leave me at home alone. You know, I'm like 10 years old, 11 years old.
Yeah.
You know, until I was like
14.
Which
you could do in the 70s and 80s without being, you know, arrested.
Oh, I know. It's just like as soon as he'd leave. And that's how I think I was really relating to those characters in Rumblefish because they were just so unsupervised, you know.
Yeah.
Not that my dad was a drunk, like Dennis Hopper character, but he just wasn't there. So I just could invite my friends over and we'd get into trouble, you know. We'd give the homeless guy in the station wagon four extra bucks to get us a fifth of Jack Daniels.
And,
you know, get drunk and smoke cigarettes and think we're really tough.
Right.
And so I really related to that. And not only that, but, oh, I know that street. I know that building.
Yeah.
You know, and it even goes deeper than that. As I got older, I was in a band with my older brother and two sisters. And we traveled the country playing bars.
Really?
Yeah.
What did everyone play? How did that break down?
So my sister played keyboards, Charisse, and Celeste sang and played some guitar. My brother played guitar and sang.
And you played drums, obviously.
And I played drums.
Were you called the Convertinos?
No, no. We had a few different names. Pretty funny names, pretty embarrassing. But
give me one.
Well, the very first one, which was really hilarious, it was August.
Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah. And then the second one was Little Brother.
That's not bad either.
And then the final formation was Stand Clear.
Well, yeah. That was a little corny.
So in the final formation, Stand Clear, we had written some songs. We'd spent a year up in Alaska playing this bar called Chilku Charlie's. And we had a batch of songs, and the goal was to record the songs, move to LA, and get a record deal.
How old are you at this point?
I'm 23.
Okay.
So this is a few years after Rumblefish. Still a huge Police fan and Stuart Copeland fan.
Yeah.
And we hook up with this music professor who taught both my brother and my sister. He was a cellist, and he was going to produce our songs, our demo. And we were going to record them at Long Branch Studios in Tulsa.
Oh, cool.
Where Stuart Copeland did Rumblefish.
Oh, so he actually recorded there.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So we get there at Long Branch Studios, and the engineer's like, so here's the drum booth. And I look at it, and it's like all the surfaces are shiny. And I was like, oh, Stuart Copeland played here. And he was like, yeah, he wanted it to be really live. He wanted the drum sound to be really live. So instead of like here in the studio, you have all this foam to deaden the sound. Copeland wanted the opposite. He wanted it all shiny and have the sound bounce around.
Huh. So what does that do?
So that makes this kind of... Well, if you hear on the song Don't Box Me In, you can, when he hits like a tom-tom, it sounds kind of boxy, but there's all this reverb.
Yeah.
It's not reverb. That's the actual room.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And it just makes for a great sound. And,
yeah.
And if you listen to our records, I'm not playing like Stuart Copeland. I mean, you can't.
Right.
As soon as you do, people go, hey, you sound like Stuart Copeland.
Yeah, yeah. He was so signature. Sure.
But I did love that sound of the room, you know, the open sound.
Yeah.
No tape or pieces of cloth over the drums, just wide open and ringing. And so I would use brushes and get that effect.
Mm-hmm.
And you can really hear it on the black light, especially. We were recording in a giant warehouse right next to the railroad tracks,
mm-hmm.
in Tucson. But I just thought that was really, I mean,
yeah,
it's really special that I got to actually be in the same drum booth that he was. And he was definitely one of my heroes.
Sure.
And
what happened with the family band? What did you guys?
So we did. We finished the demo. You know, we were super green and really didn't know what we were doing. Didn't have much of a plan once we got to L.A.
Mm-hmm.
But we managed to find a place to live. Nobody would rent to musicians.
Oh, really?
Because really, that's when we were trying to get apartments, they'd say, well, what do you do? And we'd say, well, we're musicians. We've been on the road for that. That's what we do. They'd just look at us and laugh. Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, good luck with that.
Yeah. Next.
And, but we finally found this great apartment building right in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
These landlords were Greek and Yugoslavian couple and very family oriented. And they just thought it was great that we were family.
That's cool.
That played music together.
Yeah.
They just thought that was so sweet. And there, of course, you know, we'll rent you a room. And the rest is history after that. I met Hal Gelb there from Giant Sand.
Uh-huh.
He moved into the same apartment building. He had just had a baby.
Wow, that's serendipity.
Yeah, and he was looking for a drummer.
Mm-hmm.
So that set that whole course.
And that's where you met Joey too, right?
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then when did Tucson, well, are your siblings still in music, by the way?
They're not professionally, but, you know, I think once you play music, it's always there. And yeah, they're great singers and they write some songs. And my brother and sister still live in Nashville. They moved to Nashville. And
great town.
And the sister who played keyboards still lives in Tulsa, so.
So you just saw her?
Just saw her,
and
she has a
this?
Son, my nephew, who's a drummer. I just saw him, and it's just, once again, I was just reminded of that that feeling of being a youth, you know, in a city like that, in a town like that, where, you know, it's not famous or, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's this blank slate, really.
Yeah.
It is what you make it. And
does he think Uncle John's the coolest?
He's pretty sweet kid.
Yeah.
He actually sold me in one of his cymbals. I needed a cymbal.
Oh, no way.
Yeah,
that's funny.
And I was just gonna borrow it for the night.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, you know what, I really need it. And he's like, oh, I'll sell it to you. And I was like, that'd be great. And now I can always think of you every time I smash it.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's really great.
Yeah, that's really sweet.
I'm in an old man band. I got in my first band when I was 38 years old.
Wow.
It's just me and my buddies from college and stuff all ended up living near each other. And we don't write music, or we just play cover songs. But it's just the most fun thing we do, you know, is once a month.
That's
and
so
we,
cool.
We cover Sunken Waltz, by the way.
Oh, nice.
It was one of the first ones we learned.
That is one. That's a... like one of our standards, you know, that we
it's a great song.
Can always just pop that one out.
Yeah, and I think when I see you guys live, I mean, you have such a you make it look easy. You have such a relaxed style that you don't seem like you're working hard, but I know that's an illusion.
Yeah.
And your songs always, and you back there, maybe it's just your style, but they just have such a great swing to them.
Well, thank you. Yeah, well, speaking of swing, I was in the hot seat of swing last night at that Preservation Hall.
Yeah, so for those of you listening, John came in, had a late night jam with the Preservation Hall Jazz Band in New Orleans. And was that at the same venue, or did you go somewhere?
We went to the Preservation Hall.
Oh, so you played there.
Right there in the French Quarter.
And did they just come up afterward, or were they there for the show?
So they had done a set, like one of their normal sets that they do for, you know, the tourists or whatever, where people are sitting in there, super quiet, super acoustic. And that's one of the most beautiful things about the Preservation Hall is that they'll play a set with no microphones at all.
Oh, cool.
So the guy's like singing just into the room.
Uh-huh.
And so they were doing one of those sets where the crowd were making requests, you know, and it's like if you request When the Saints come in, marching in, you have to pay $20. other requests are $5.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think standards or traditional songs are $10.
Gotcha.
But the Saints is $20.
Is that the max?
That's the max.
Yeah.
That sign's been up there for a long time, and it's steadily gone. You know, the prices have gotten bigger and bigger.
Good.
But yeah. But so they finished that set, and then we had a couple of hours just to hang out with them in the back room and just kind of show them a few of our songs.
Yeah.
And they showed us a few of their songs.
And, so much fun, I bet.
It was really cool.
How'd you really do?
We did, I think we did pretty good.
That's got to be a little nerve-wracking.
We got a couple of really great soloists. Actually, our bass player played an amazing solo, and our guitar player from Madrid, Spain, Jairo, played a couple of great guitar solos. And Jacob Valenzuela, he's got some jazz roots. And it was really, really special hearing him play with those guys. I mean, he really held his own. And then when we were all playing together, Sergio Mendoza played this amazing, you know, kind of Latin-based piano solo that I could see those guys that pricked their ears. They were like, whoa.
Really?
Yeah, they were like, you know. And he kind of threw some Ellingtonian kind of chords in there. And they totally picked up on that.
Wow, that's
great.
Got some
nice big smiles.
So cool.
And
it
then,
must be fun at this point, too, just to do that, you know.
Oh, I mean, it was, I'm a huge jazz fan.
Yeah.
But I've never had the talent to play it, or never have had like the opportunity, you know, to play it. It's just, that's the kind of thing where you have to do every night for hours and hours and hours.
Right.
Jam sessions like that every day for hours. And where that kind of polyrhythmic swinging stuff is just flowing out of you like water. And I have that flowing out of me like water, but it's something more simple, like Sung and Waltz, or you know, it's a simplified version, you know. And I like to leave a lot more space in my drumming,
right?
And
yeah, that's
it's a different thing. And I was doing that last night, and at times I was like, "Is this really working?" And I guess it just has to work because this is the way I play. And, and the trombone player, I was right when I was thinking that, he was playing a solo, the trombone player from the hall. He turns around and looks at me and he's like, it's my turn. And I'm like, oh, I don't do drum solos, you know. But, you know, I had to. It's just like,
what do you do?
Yeah. So I went for it, and man, it was, like I said, it was a hot seat.
That's pretty cool.
But I found my way, you know. Bill Bruford, drummer for Yes, he always said, when in doubt, roll. And so I was in doubt, so I just started doing this press roll. And there's a lot to a press roll.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like a simple thing, you know, but it's a lifetime achievement.
Really?
Yeah. A really good press roll that can go from press to single stroke, back and forth. That's a lifetime achievement. And
did you nail it?
I nailed it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
I don't know where
moment.
It came from, but it came out, and so it was a lot of fun.
Well, now, as a touring musician, then, that's a great time to ask this. How do you get up for Atlanta?
Well,
we all like to think we're special in each city.
Yeah.
But after something like that, I mean, it's a letdown, right?
No, it really isn't. I mean, yeah, especially Atlanta, because I feel like there's diversity in the city,
sure.
You know, and again, I love that about Rumblefish.
Yeah.
That, you know, Rusty James, I want to go across the river.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, that whole scene.
Yeah. I want to go, you know, to the other part, the bad part or whatever part of town. And, you know, obviously there's a lot more color.
Yeah.
To that part of town and a lot more happening.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was a great scene too. I kind of forgotten that actually the first time as a kid watching it, but I just thought that was great that, you know, Coppola threw that in there, and
he spent a lot of time there too. That was a good middle chunk of that movie. For those of you listening, if you haven't seen it, the movie is about Rusty James, and you can't forget because they say that name
a lot,
you know, 100 times. who is Matt Dillon's character as a teenager. We learned that we thought his mother had passed away probably, mm-hmm. but we learned later that she is alive and just had left them.
Mm-hmm.
Drunk father that's not around, and this legend of an older brother, mm-hmm. The motorcycle boy, who is Mickey Rourke's character.
Who we never know what his real name is.
Yeah, and we never really know why he's such a legend.
Yeah, I mean,
like, you get the feeling there was an incident because that cop hates his guts.
Right.
But we don't really know. We just know he's left town mm-hmm. as a legend among all the communities, because when they're in the black community in the pool hall, those guys are like, yeah, your brother's, like, he's the shit.
Yeah, he's the prince. He's a prince.
Yeah, he's a prince. And he, you know, Matt Dillon wants to be him, but he's, you know, he's, for lack of a better word, he's not super smart.
Right.
And everyone reminds him of that.
Yeah.
And it's very much a movie about not even sibling rivalry, more like sibling idolization.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Admiration.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I was thinking about it this morning when, you know, because Matt Dillon, you know, he's such a hunk. He's like known as this really pretty boy mm-hmm. actor, Hollywood actor. But he really is a good actor.
Yeah.
And those moments where he's confused,
mm-hmm.
like where he feels like he's being outsmarted by his brother and even his dad.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about the Greek.
Yeah. Yeah. What were they talking about?
Yeah. So I was thinking about that and I was like, well, that's the tragedy, you know?
Okay.
Like a Greek tragedy uh-huh. is when, you know, you have the wisdom or you have the power.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't know how to use it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Matt Dillon, what Rusty James, the father and the brother are looking at him like, you have the power.
Uh-huh.
You have this good looks or this strength. You may not have wisdom, but you have the power. And the tragedy is you're not seeing what it is.
Yeah.
You don't know how to use it.
Yeah, and it's kind of tragic, too, because he kept saying, you know, I might look like him one day.
Yeah. Oh,
you're like, man, you look how you look,
right.
Brother. You are
use that.
17 or 18 years old. You're not gonna look like your brother that's, they said he was old. He was 21, which is kind of a funny part of that movie.
I know.
But
he does look a lot older.
Yeah, he comes across as older, too.
Yeah.
But then when you, as an adult watching this movie, like I saw it when I was younger.
Uh-huh.
But now that I'm in my late 40s, I uh-huh. watch it and you don't see Motorcycle Boy as anyone who was going anywhere.
Right.
Or worth anything.
Right. So in that case, the cop was really right.
Oh God, it's hard to admit though, right?
Yeah, I know. But what you do see is Motorcycle Boy as being sensitive.
Sure.
And that's what, again, that's the tragedy, that he loses his life when he could have, you know, he could have used that to help his brother.
Yeah.
And even his dad, you know. And I think his dad was recognizing, oh, yeah, he feels too much.
Mm-hmm.
He's like this raw nerve. And he feels so much that he has to have these blockers,
mm-hmm.
whether it's that he's colorblind or that he can't hear sometimes.
Yeah,
it's
an interesting character thing.
I think. And that's where Mickey Rourke is so brilliant, because it's all in his eyes.
Mm-hmm.
He's got these big eyes that are just like rolling around and looking up inside of his head. You know, what's he thinking about?
Yeah, he was really good in this.
So good.
I kind of forgot what a great actor Mickey Rourke was.
So good.
And then, you know, Diane Lane has that great... one of my first crushes was mm-hmm. Diane Lane from The Outsiders.
Mm-hmm.
Still so beautiful. But mm-hmm. She has that great line when she's talking to Rusty James and he says something about wanting to be cool, like his brother. And she's like, you're better than cool. You're warm.
Mm.
And it was such a good line. And he just couldn't wrap his head around that.
Yeah. No, he's got all that, you know, rage.
Yeah.
I gotta prove myself.
Yeah.
Damn it. But yeah.
Really tragic too, because this is one of those movies where, although in the ending, it's a semi victorious ending in that he finally makes his way to the ocean And they had that great shot in silhouette of him with the seagulls.
It's great.
But you hope as a viewer, like, you hope that that marked a turn in his life.
Yeah.
Because he was headed toward his father's life.
Right.
Of just a drunk guy in Tulsa.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, again, I parallel that to my own life because I wound up in California, you know, and I think, you know, it's not everyone's story, but it's a lot of people's story.
Sure.
Artists that go to a major city, whether it be New York or LA, but they're on the coasts and they're on the edge of the world, so to speak. You're there looking out over the ocean, and there's something that opens up within yourself, or it did for me.
Right.
And I'd always thought I'd wind up in New York because that's where I was born. And I related to the bands and the movies from the East Coast. And but I wound up in California.
Right.
And, you know, I remember taking Route 1 down Sunset Boulevard, take the bus from La Brea and just go west on the bus all the way to the Pacific Palisades.
Yep.
And get dropped off there, and I'd walk along the coast to Santa Monica Boulevard and take it back. And you could do those kind of things in your early 20s.
Yeah.
You know, just take a whole day.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, that's the other beauty of Rumblefish is this, when you have that kind of time.
Right.
You know, and he references time a lot in the movie.
A lot.
And you have
clocks are all over the place.
Yeah. You have that great line from Tom Waits, you know.
Geez, Tom Waits showed up.
Yeah, he shows up and gives you this, yeah, you think you have all this time.
Mm-hmm.
And then you realize, I just got 35 more summers.
Oh, God, dude.
Just 35 summers.
That line, like, was like a gut punch last night when I heard it.
Yeah, it's different now.
It's way different now.
So you're in your...
Because I don't have 35. I'm 47, so...
Yeah, I'm just turned 55.
Yeah,
so.
I don't know if I have 35 more summers even. So
I'm on the countdown.
Oh boy. Yeah. There was a lot of gut punches in this movie.
Yeah.
A lot of great lines. Like the other one that stood out to me was, and kind of underscored kind of what a dummy that Rusty James was, is when Mickey Rourke says that he asked him if he went to the ocean, he went, no, California got in the way.
Yeah.
And he didn't get it at all.
Yeah.
But you know, he was operating on a slightly different level than his little brother.
Yeah.
Well, I have my own history in Tulsa. I adopted my daughter there 3 years ago. So,
wow,
3 summers ago, and the birth mom was late by almost 2 weeks. So we spent about 3.5 weeks in Tulsa.
Wow,
3 summers ago, and having never been there,
wow,
and it all came together very fast within like a few weeks' time.
Mm-hmm.
We were just there, and we stayed at an apartment, an Airbnb, and I think they call it the East Village area now, which seems fairly newish. I don't even know if it was a thing probably back then.
Mm-hmm.
But
not sure.
Got to know the bars on that block from stress drinking.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, tried to – it's a very stressful situation. And I imagine like there's no easy way to get a baby, whether you have it yourself or adopt or whatever. But – We tried to take in what we could of Tulsa while we were there and grew to appreciate it. You know, we went to the Woody Guthrie Museum, which is great.
Awesome.
And toured saw the Frank Lloyd Wright house that's
very
in
cool.
Tulsa.
Yeah.
And tried to go on some walks in other neighborhoods. And we would just drive to whatever cool neighborhood we heard of and we would walk.
There's a, how about the Philbrook Art Museum? Did you happen to go to that?
Went there.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Did not get
beautiful
to Canes.
Part.
We wanted to, the legendary music venue.
Yeah.
Because Jason Isbell was playing while we were
very
there.
Very cool.
So we were on standby that day for like a hospital trip. So I couldn't go, but I saw him at a cafe eating lunch. And so I had to go.
Amazing.
I was like, hey, man, I'm just a huge fan. And he's like, you coming
tonight?
I'm
getting ready to be a father.
No, I did. He said, you coming tonight? I was like, well, I can't because, you know.
Yeah.
I gave him the quick version, but he was a real sweet guy.
That's great.
And we did not get to go to a minor league baseball game. That's the other kind of fun thing you can do there now.
Yeah.
It's that cool stadium kind of right there downtown.
Right. That came way after I'd left, but.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting place.
It really is. And you think about the musical history, too.
Yeah.
You know, J.J. Cale, Leon Russell. Roy Clark.
Yeah.
I mean, the list goes on. I mean, it's really I guess it's just that right smack dab in the middle of the country, mm-hmm. you know, that it was a stop off.
Yeah.
And I think it had some money, you know, it had its oil boom.
Yeah. We went through some of those neighborhoods on walks.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. Really amazing houses.
Sheesh. Yeah. That's like where the Philbrook Art Museum is. Uh-huh. And,
oh, yeah. Philbrook. That's totally where we went.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Had nice
gardens
there.
My sister works there.
Oh,
she's,
really?
She's been there for like over 20 years, I think. Yeah.
Well, we may have met her.
Yeah, you could have.
We were there a couple of times.
Yeah, it's really an interesting and beautiful city, mm-hmm. and it has a great history. My father came home from work one day and asked us kids if we'd ever heard of who Leon Russell. Mm-hmm. Do you kids know who Leon Russell is? And my sister went through the roof. Of course, you know, he's amazing.
Yeah, because she played the piano.
Yeah, well, she had his records. Mm-hmm. And he was like, well, I sold him two Steinway grands, 9-foot Steinway grands today.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I guess they kind of hit it off. They weren't like buddies or mm-hmm. anything, but he would have my dad tune his piano occasionally.
That's
every so
cool.
often. And so we have the Leon Russell connection.
Uh-huh.
And you have this amazing drummer, Jamie Oldacre, who played with J.J. Cale and Leon Russell. And it's just an amazing, he had this incredible groove that became kind of the Tulsa sound
mm-hmm.
that Eric Clapton heard and totally stole.
I mean,
stole, however you want to put it. He was inspired by it.
Eric Clapton was inspired by a lot of people.
Yeah. Inspired and, you know, made it his own.
Mm-hmm.
But and with all due respect to J.J. Cale, I'm sure J.J. Cale didn't mind Cocaine becoming a huge hit.
Yeah.
Or After Midnight or any of those songs. But anyway, it really all comes together with that movie for me. All those memories and it was really fun to watch it again here later in life.
Yeah, you know, like, it's one of those that takes on a different meaning, I'm sure.
It really, really does. And I was going to revisit The Outsiders, but it didn't hit me like Rumblefish did. And uh-huh. I guess a lot of it had to do with Stuart Copeland and he doing the soundtrack.
Yeah, let's talk about that a sec, because uh-huh. he, it's a really interesting score.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say it's very percussive, which sounds redundant.
Yeah.
But it is.
Yeah.
And he really has he almost keeps the tempo of the movie
mm-hmm.
and drives that like sense of urgency as it goes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting soundtrack.
Yeah. And the melodic parts too
uh-huh.
are eerie and very edgy.
Yeah.
And a little bit comical too, which mm-hmm. is kind of plays into Rusty James's, like, I don't know what's going, you know, what's going on,
mm-hmm.
you know, what, you know, he says what a lot and why, what and why.
Mm-hmm.
And, you hear that in the music, you really do. And, it's just, you know, and that's kind of the height of their careers too. The Police were really big then.
Yeah.
I think. Maybe Ghost in the Machine or...
Yeah, I mean, that was right at the sort of the pinnacle, kind of pre...
Synchronicity.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And it just made me realize, wow, I got so much more to learn as a musician.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't just be a drummer, you know?
Yeah.
If I'm going to live up to one of my idols, I've got to learn. I've got to sit at the piano a lot more.
Yeah,
you know, and I need to pick up the guitar. And
do you play everything?
I do. I mean, I play a lot of the stuff on the early, early Calexico records.
Oh,
the,
really?
The vibes and the marimba and the accordion,
oh, cool.
and all that stuff. But as the band grew, it's like, well, I want Martin. Martin's playing great accordion, and you know, they all started learning the parts
mm-hmm.
to play the songs live. And then they were learning the instruments themselves, and it's great to have them play the instruments in the studio. And it's just not Joey and I,
right?
We're a band now. There's other guys, but it broadened broadened my scope a lot. And there, you know, drumming is an art in of itself. It's not, I'm just the drummer, but it's great to explore those other instruments.
Yeah.
You know, and especially the vibes and the marimba. And because they're basically a keyboard, and but giant, it's like a giant sized keyboard.
Uh-huh.
So you, it made it easier for me to understand how melody falls over chord progressions.
Yeah.
I it doesn't make sense to me on a guitar. I don't know how that happens on a guitar. It just seems like my mind just doesn't work that way. I'm a Rusty James on the guitar.
What?
Yeah, what?
Do you and Joey write together still everything? Or?
Yeah, no, not everything.
How does that work?
Well, I think he's always been a great songwriter, but he's developed more and more into like a singer-songwriter where he's coming up with the lyrics and melody, and it's all coming up at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of how singer-songwriters get their songs together, and he's really developed that a lot. In the early days, it was more like, you know, just Joey on guitar, me on the drums, and we just started dialogue. You know, I got this groove, or I got this one progression. We used to exchange ideas on phone machines.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know, I was like,
so
I had this
play
really
something
on the phone, yeah, and yeah. knowing that he's it's recording on his machine, just because I didn't want to forget it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's pretty cool.
And so
it's
play
it's on
back.
Tape, at least.
Yeah, it's on tape. And now, of course, we have our cell phones, and you can record anything you want anytime.
Yeah, that's kind of nice.
Yeah, it's really nice. And it really helped on this last record because he's a father now.
Uh-huh.
He's got 7-year-old twin daughters. And
oh, wow.
You know, it's hard to juggle it all.
Yeah.
To be the family man and the musician and the road guy, too. So he was getting a lot of his ideas on the cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
While he's cooking breakfast and getting the girls ready for school, and so he'd play me ideas. He plays me ideas, and I could work that in, and but for this new record, yeah, he had a lot of the basic song ideas done. Mm-hmm.
Where'd you record the new one?
At Panoramic House in Stinson Beach.
Oh, I know about that place.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Holy cow!
Yeah.
So is you record there because you can, right?
I mean, well, we got a...
it's amazing.
Yeah. We got a great deal. The owner is really good friends with Craig Schumacher, who's been our co-producer and engineer for all the records. And it was... we're going to be recording in the summer. So we thought about the studio outside of El Paso, Sonic Ranch.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's our own studio that we work in a lot in Tucson. But you know, when it gets into triple digits, it's just like, it's brutal.
Yeah, yeah.
And the thought of being right there on the Pacific Coast.
Man, that place is unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, my drums are set up right, you know, in front of this giant window overlooking the tide coming in, and the fog coming in, and the deer walking by, and the seagulls, and the fog, and the rain, and
I'm sure that informs the record, right?
I really believe it did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the song, The Town of Miss Lorraine,
great
was written
song.
Up there.
Uh-huh.
And it was like this gift. You know, it was like the gate opened up, and you know, from that moment on, we were on a roll.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Thrown to the Wild. Some of the instrumentals came out there.
Yeah.
Lots of gifts, you know, where, you know, the recording and the writing and the basic foundation of the song was all happening at once.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like, oh, can we do that again? That was really great. It was like, nope. Yeah, I already got it.
Yeah.
You know, we already have it.
That's cool to be, I think, at this point in your career, too, to still be open to experience and to not, I think it would be easy, just as an outsider, it seems like it would be easy to just go in and be not rigid, but like, all right, this is the new Calexico record.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the songs written.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go bang them out in the studio and do a great job. But It sounds like you guys were really open to, like once you got there even.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just changing things up a little.
Yeah, you got to roll those dice and leave it open. And like I was mentioning before, yeah, the soundtrack work is somewhat easier because you have this direction, mm-hmm. you have the scene to write to. And when you're in the studio, you really don't have, you have to like kind of either pull it out of the air, or you're inspired by your environment. And I think, you know, when Joey picked up that guitar, it had this feel to it, to him, you know, like a 60s folk song, like like a Leonard Cohen or Joni Mitchell kind of feel.
Yeah.
And then he's walking around outside and it's like the beginning of a Wes Anderson movie, you know, and he's like totally inspired.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't have happened in Tucson.
Yeah.
Something else would have happened. But yeah, I mentioned Wes Anderson. I mean, we're really inspired by movies a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, he's the best.
You know, the Coen brothers had a lot to do with maybe The Black Light and some of Feast of Wire. And what's that composer's name? I think it's Burwell. Or
Carter Burwell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Carter Burwell.
Yeah. That,
talk about simplicity.
Yeah, I had one of my previous guests did Miller's Crossing, and
nice
that score is just like one of the all time greats.
Yeah.
And again, yeah, like you said, that much like Dead Man, the score for Miller's Crossing has that one little bit that he just does in a variety of ways.
Right.
You know, loud and soft, music swells, music fades.
Yeah.
But it's just so effective.
Yeah. Yeah. The Coen brothers take on No Country for Old Men.
Mm. So great.
Big Cormac McCarthy fans.
Yeah, me too.
And so yeah, it's good stuff.
Yeah, that's one of the few books that really, like, I was kind of 100% on that movie.
Yeah.
They nailed it.
They did. They really did.
Is Blood Meridian ever going to be a movie? I know they've tried. Various.
Yeah.
It's been attached to various people over the years, but.
I wouldn't go see All the Pretty Horses just because.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I wouldn't go see it.
I don't think I saw that one either.
I love that book too much.
Yeah.
I don't trust anybody with it.
No, I know that feeling.
Or Ask the Dust.
Mm-hmm.
The John Fante book was made into a movie, and I'm like, there's no way I'm going to watch that. That's just.
Yeah.
That book means too much to me.
Don't fuck it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, all right. We can finish up here with a couple of segments.
Okay.
I finish up with one called What Ebert Said and then Five Questions.
Okay.
This movie is a complete disappointment.
I always like to go back and see what Roger Ebert thought of these films. And Rumblefish, it got mixed reviews at the time. I mean, a lot of people, it was a very brave, arty movie. I mean, I think Coplay even called it an art film for teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
And also, shout out to Sophia Coppola, little young Sophia.
Domino.
I know. I didn't even realize it.
Yeah.
My wife and I were watching it last night. We were like, oh my God.
That's
little
her.
Sophia.
I know.
Right
she's
there.
So great, too.
She was. Maybe her best acting performance. As a
and
kid.
Introducing Domino. And I was like, wait a minute. Because I was looking for her name.
Yeah.
But
she had those big adult sized teeth and that little kid mouth.
Yeah.
It was very cute.
Super cute.
But a brave movie for him to make at the time. A lot of critics didn't like it and didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
I think of it as nothing but brave.
Yeah.
He really rolled the dice. He was clearly not, well, I don't know about clearly not concerned about making a commercial movie because he expressed great disappointment that teenagers didn't flock to it like they did Outsiders.
Right.
But he was trying to give them something more to chew on.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
But Ebert did like it. He gave it 3.5 out of 4 stars.
Great.
And he said, this is a movie you are likely to hate unless you can love it for its crazy, feverish charm. And it's all style and flash, all emotion and impact, and it doesn't slow down for the usual items of business. It lays a weird-looking, experimental film style on top of a fairly basic story about hoods and street gangs. And if you care how the story turns out, you're in the wrong movie. I thought Rumblefish was offbeat, daring, and utterly original.
Great.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, it wasn't it didn't have like a traditional narrative arc.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of just a slice of this kid's life,
mm-hmm.
and what happens in this moment in time. It feels like, what, like a week maybe?
Yeah. Yeah. But I think I have to disagree with, I think there is a lot going on there with the family though. And I think he's making a really deep statement about family. Like,
yeah.
Like how important it is.
Well, and he says about not caring about, yeah. Like, I don't agree with that either.
Yeah.
I cared a great deal and it was very tragic in the end.
Really tragic.
When Motorcycle Boy is murdered by that cop.
Yeah.
Off screen.
Right.
I think in the book, I read a little bit about the differences. In the book, S.E. Hinton, it was supposedly a warning shot.
Mm-hmm.
But Rusty James knew like the real truth.
Yeah.
But they don't even spell it out in the movie. He's just dead.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's really deep, and it made me think about, you know, my relationship to my father and my brother.
I have an older brother too.
Yeah,
who I idolize, so it's sort of all there.
It's all there, mm-hmm. you know. And then, you know, for me, it was my divorce. You know,
mm-hmm.
my mom wasn't there, and I was just hanging with my dad, and he was kind of, you know, a little bit wild.
Yeah,
you know? I mean, he was the musician and. Yeah, so I think there's a lot to chew on there and a lot of really great acting.
Yeah.
You know, and you get to see Nicolas Cage as a young man.
Yeah, I mean, in that very first scene, it's like, wait, there's Chris Penn.
Yeah,
Chris Penn. And there's Nick Cage and Vincent Spano.
Right.
And then, is that Tom Waits behind the bar?
I know. It's Tom super Waits skinny Tom bar. Waits.
Yeah. it was a pretty impactful first scene. And then, Matt Dillon, you know, holding this thing down as a teen heartthrob at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, And I mean, Coppola, I could see where, he would be disappointed. I mean, but it holds up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I saw an interview with him about The Godfather and how he was saying, when you make something and you hope that in 25 years, it'll still be. Mm-hmm. Great to watch, and he felt like his movie The Godfather had held up.
Yeah,
and I think it still holds up.
Well, he loves. I think he rates out Rumblefish as one of his five favorites of his own.
Did you ever see? I might be saying the name wrong. I think it's Tatro.
No,
you got to see it.
The other black and white film.
It's so good, Vincent Gallo.
Yeah, I will check.
I've
that
only seen it once. I saw it in the movie theater.
Uh huh.
And I just walked away like loving that movie. And
really?
Just was like, and then I was talking to friends. Have you seen the Coppola movie and the new Coppola? No, nobody's seen it.
Yeah, it really flew under the radar.
It's really cool.
I mean, he's.
I have to revisit that.
He's a true artist.
Yeah.
And he's making, always, I think, made movies that he felt like were works of art.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about holding up. I mean, Rumblefish certainly fares better than any other teen movie from 1986.
Oh, yeah. 83.
Oh, yeah, 83.
Yeah.
Of course.
Wow.
You know.
Yeah, for sure.
If you want to throw it in that, you can't even lump it into that. It's just not even close.
No.
They weren't.
No, it's really, I mean, it's Dennis Hopper. I just.
Yeah. And such a small role.
Yeah. And there's just
Larry
so
Fishburne.
Meaty. Yeah.
Young Larry Fishburne.
That's right.
Post-apocalypse now.
Yep.
But still young, skinny Larry Fishburne.
Yep.
I forgot he was in that first scene. Pretty great stuff.
It really is.
All right, so we'll finish with five questions. First movie you remember seeing in the movie theater?
I love that because I so totally remember it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was born on Long Island in New York. And I'll never forget this. One day, my mom rounded all of us kids together, threw us into the station wagon, and drove us down to Manhattan, or up to Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
To Radio City Music Hall.
Oh, wow.
And we saw True Grit.
Oh, wow.
Because my mom was a huge Glenn Campbell fan.
Uh-huh.
We used to watch the Glenn Campbell show.
Yeah.
And she was so excited to see Glenn Campbell in a movie. And
one of the great underrated guitar players of all time.
Oh, man.
Or I don't know, underrated, but I think to most people that like, the Rhinestone Cowboy guy.
Right. Well, yeah, they think of him as a singer.
Yeah, but they don't realize he was so smoking hot on the guitar.
Yeah, he was a session player.
Yeah.
He was badass. And so there we are at the Radio City Music Hall with with the dancers mm-hmm. and the organ, and it was just magical.
Yeah.
And then, like, I think I must have been like five or six, mm-hmm. totally remember this. In the middle of the movie, I get really thirsty. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm just like dying of thirst. And I start bugging my mom, you know, really thirsty. She doesn't want to leave.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, she doesn't want to leave the movie. And she goes, just hold on. And, you know, it'll be over soon. And she's like, I'm really thirsty. And then I nudge my sister and I'm really thirsty. She was like, well, I have milk duds. The milk in them will.
The worst thing you can have if you're thirsty, probably.
So I ate a couple of milk duds and then I'm really dying. And she finally, my mom relents and she picks me. I remember her picking me up and taking me to the water fountain, drinking the water. And I'm telling this whole story only to, because, you know, fast forward to my adult life, mm-hmm. We're opening, Calexico's opening up for Andrew Bird. Mm-hmm. The Radio City Musical.
Oh, neat.
This is the second time. This is only the second time I've ever been there. Mm-hmm. And so I'm there at the Radio City Music Hall and remembering all that.
Yeah.
And like walking around the balcony and it's like, this is pretty much where we sat. Uh-huh. This is the water fountain she dragged me to. It's all the same.
Uh-huh.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And
that's great.
And I remember the stage manager took me downstairs and showed me the organ. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you see this hydraulic system for the stage? This was the first of its kind. And worldwide theaters were copying this. And it's the same one. It's still working to this day.
Man.
From 1930, whatever it was. Maybe 20s.
So cool.
Yeah. It was really a great experience.
Is that the only time you played there?
Yeah.
Maybe Hopefully, it should be.
Yeah, maybe it should be. Yeah. Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. I wish you had a thousand more performances.
No,
there.
No.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first R-rated movie that you saw?
I do. And so my brother and my dad, they got to go see The Godfather when it came out, but mm-hmm. I was too young. And they thought it was too much for me to see. So as soon as I could, that was the first R-rated movie I saw.
Oh, really?
Yeah. As far as I can remember. Uh-huh. Because I couldn't wait to see it. And
such a great movie.
Yeah.
Talk about holding up.
No kidding. I mean, I pretty much have it memorized, but.
Yeah, I mean, I still watch it, you know, every
Sleeps
couple
with
of
the
years.
Fishes, you know?
Yeah, so good.
Yeah.
I'm surprised no one's picked that one for the show yet, but I'm sure it's coming.
Yeah. Well, it was one of my first choices I thought of. Mm-hmm. Because I just love it. And it's the Italian-American story.
Yeah.
It's my father. And I, you know, he, after seeing it, he was like, oh, yeah, I remember cousins. Mm-hmm. He had a cousin that really reminded him of Sonny. Uh-huh. So I guess my grandmother was more Northern Italian, mm-hmm. had red hair. And my grandfather was from Bari, which is Southern Italian, not Sicilian. Uh-huh. But there's a whole story where the mafia confronted my dad, not confronted him, but mm-hmm. they asked him because he had a music school. Mm-hmm. They wanted to use his music school as a front.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Because it was like nobody, this is in Long Island, uh-huh. in the basement of our house. We had this beautiful basement and he had three classrooms down there. And it was violin, guitar and accordion mm-hmm. and piano. And they thought it was perfect. No one's going to suspect this little music school where all these kids are coming in and out of running drugs through there.
It's the perfect front.
Yeah. And my dad was just like,
music cases are perfect for carrying drugs.
My dad's just like, no way. There's absolutely no way.
Yeah.
And they were like, okay, we respect that. But here's a number in case you ever need anything.
Well, at least they didn't go, are you sure?
Yeah. Right.
Give you the night
I don't
to
know.
Think about
you
it.
Know, we lived in a really pretty house. Maybe
there's another story.
Maybe there. there's an underground story there. But yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's some real deal shit right there.
Yeah.
Will you walk, number three, will you walk out of a bad movie?
I have.
Do you remember one?
I do. And it's the only one I've walked out of.
Oh, okay.
And it was. I think I don't even remember the title, but it was the one about a tornado that like they kind of make the tornado.
Twister?
Yeah, it must have been Twister. Yeah, I walked
out of that. With Bill Paxton?
Maybe, yeah. I just, as soon as I saw like the Twister like get a face, you know, like they CG'd a face in it and like it made this sound like.
Oh, no, probably not Twister. Probably a different one.
It was bad.
If there was a face in it, yeah, bad. So you're out of there. That's a good decision, I think.
Yeah, it just like, and you know, I'm a staunch believer in like you pay the money, you're in the theater, you know, just hang in there with it and at least enjoy the popcorn and the escapism. But this was just so bad.
Yeah.
I couldn't stand it. Oh, actually, it reminds me of a second one. My wife and I went to, I think it was Neighbors. It's a more recent movie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, with the Seth Rogen movie?
Yeah. Yeah,
you walked out of that one?
We were both just like, oh my God, this is awful. It's just, this is not our world anymore. It just, this is really dating me and my wife, I think. But we were just like, no, I can't stand another minute of this. It's just not funny. And it's just gross and just making me think really bad things.
Yeah. So did you go home and stream on Golden Pond?
Yeah, no, not quite, but we were both just really relieved to be out of there.
Yeah, sometimes that's the right move these days.
Yeah, for sure.
This is a specifically written for you in this case. I usually mix it up on number four.
Mm-hmm.
What movie score do you wish you had written?
Oh, wow. Well, that...
Which is sort of another way of saying what might be your favorite.
Yeah. That's a really tough one, huh? Mm-hmm. But yeah, I just think of my favorite movies, I guess. You know, I mentioned No Country for Old Men, which is, I'm a great lover of books. And so a really great adaptation with a really great soundtrack. You have that. You have, well, I just recently watched Barton Fink.
Oh, God, what a great movie.
Which I think is just such a badass movie. Talk about going deep.
Yeah.
You know.
I saw that. That came out when I was in college, and I was an English major. My buddies and I, we probably watched that thing 25 times that year.
Yeah. And for me, watching that, revisiting that one, I realized, oh, he's talking about listening.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing is about people not listening to each other.
Yeah.
And how relevant is that today when we're staring into these little screens? You know, we're not like you and I, we've been looking at each other and talking, having this great time.
Mm-hmm.
How often does that happen anymore?
I know. Maybe that's why I started the show. I don't even know. But
move.
Goodman has that at the end.
Yeah.
And he literally screams at him. You don't listen.
Yeah. It's like you come into my house.
Yeah.
Telling me about how. You know about the common man, the hardworking man, and you don't even hear one of my stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good stuff.
Chills.
Yeah, great movie.
Yeah.
Head in a box, too. It's always a good way to end a film. all right, and finally, movie going 101, when you get out to the theater, what's your ritual like? Where do you sit? Where do you get?
Yeah.
At the concession stand?
I mean, if it wasn't for popcorn, you know, I may just...
Stay at home.
Yeah. Just love popcorn. So it's a big bucket of popcorn.
Butter?
Not too much, but some. Salt. Mm-hmm. Salt and grease. Mm-hmm. Love it. And, you know, I like to go for the prime seat in the middle if I can get it. And normally, if it's something I really want to see, I would prefer to go alone.
Okay. Yeah. I'm big on that.
Sometimes it's date nights are fun with the wife, but it's as soon as you go with someone, you start to feel like it's a shared experience, which is cool. But you could be really loving a certain part and that other person isn't getting it and I want to love it 100%. I want to know that
on your own terms.
Yeah. And recently, I got to see the Blade Runner sequel, All Alone.
Did you like it?
I loved it.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, and I was all alone in the theater, too. I think I was the only one. It was a matinee, and I live in El Paso now, and, you know, I don't think people go to matinees in a weekday mm-hmm. in El Paso very often. And it was just, it was delicious. It was like, wow.
That's cool.
This is such a feast.
Mm-hmm.
That's just such a great escapism movie, you know? Just
yeah.
let yourself, let your mind just go there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a big fan of the first one, too.
Yeah.
I was living in L.A., you know, it was right when I moved to L.A. And
talk about a great score.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah, Vangelis.
Yeah.
Yeah, and for the new one, he combines it with Zimmerman, Hans Zimmerman.
Mm, right.
So a lot of those big, deep tones, you know, just big, giant bass notes.
Yeah.
So ominous.
What was the name of the last cut on your last album? The slow one.
That was Vanishing Mind.
Yes.
Yeah.
That one, because you said low tone.
Yeah.
And when that first came out, I re-listened to that song probably 10 times in a row.
Wow.
It was one of those things where at the very end, it finishes with that low tone.
Mm-hmm.
It goes lower and lower.
Yeah.
And just when you think it is at its lowest point, you guys hit it with that last fucking rumble. And I got to see you do that tour live in New York at,
Webster Hall?
Webster Hall.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you guys did that one live there. Cause that was one I was like, oh, there's no way they're going to do this one live. Cause it's, you know, such a slow song and stuff.
Right.
But, yeah, man, that low tone, it just is like right in the gut.
That was kind of our
good stuff.
Our nod to Gustav Mahler.
Okay.
I'm a huge Mahler fan.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of like, yeah, I like some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, so when we were figuring out the scoring, that string part, like what the hell, take it down another octave, go all the way.
I didn't know it could get that low.
Yeah. And we actually wound up having to mix it. I don't know if I should tell all the secrets. Joey always, he's always an open book. He tells all the secrets.
Uh-huh.
I'm always like, man, don't tell.
Hold a little back.
Hold back a little bit. Let the mystery, perpetrate the myth a little bit, uh-huh. right? So that really low note, I don't think you can go that low with stringed instruments. So we doubled it with a synthesizer.
Okay.
That could go that low.
I wondered about that.
Yeah. Yeah. But we did do it. I don't know if you're familiar with Spiritoso. It's a record we did I think it was right after Edge of This, no, Algiers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Algiers, yeah. All right. I'm getting
confused. Was it a collaboration?
Yeah, so it's with, we had some of our songs scored for orchestra. And then, when Algiers came out, we had a few more, The Vanishing Mind,
mm-hmm.
and a few more off that record. Done. And then we did a concert with the Vienna Radio Orchestra and the Berlin Radio Orchestra.
Man.
And again, a very hot seat playing mm-hmm. with a 70-piece symphonic orchestra.
Little intimidating.
With timpanis and shit behind you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, conductors in tuxedos and you know, real musicians.
Uh-huh. So you did Vanishing Mind with them?
Yeah. And that was an amazing moment.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I got to check that out.
Yeah. So not just one double bass, but, you know, like five basses going all the way down.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Very cool.
It was really cool.
All right. Thanks, man.
Yeah. My pleasure,
Chuck. It was a lot of fun.
That was. This was. Thanks.
All right. Well, thanks for coming in. I'll see you tonight.
All right.
All right, everybody. I think you could tell I enjoyed that one. I had a grin on my face most of the time because not only was I able to sit down with one of my musical heroes, with John, but we really hit it off. I think I have a sort of a new pal. Maybe when he comes to Atlanta next time, we'll hang out a bit. He picked Rumblefish, as you can tell. He had a lot of connections there with Tulsa, Oklahoma, with his family story, having an older brother and his father and Stuart Copeland is the cherry on top as a drummer doing the score, kind of all came together. And it's really no surprise why he picked Rumblefish, and his insight on it was really great. had a good time talking to him. And like he said in the podcast, it's really something to just sit down and speak with someone, even someone you don't know, for an hour and 15 minutes and not look at your phone and just look at each other eye to eye. Doesn't happen anymore. So maybe that's why I started the show, like I told him. And he is a very sweet guy, because I actually got the album wrong at the very end when I was talking about the song with the deep rumble. And I said it was from his last album. It was actually two albums ago. It's on Algiers, The Vanishing Mind, not The Edge of the Sun. But he didn't call me out because he's a nice guy. I ended up going to the show that night, like I said. He was kind enough to put me and Emily and Scotty on the guest list. And we all went, and we got backstage, and we got to meet all the dudes and have a little post-show hang. And like I said before, the crowd, it was a Monday night, man, and those Monday night shows are tough. But by the end of the show, people are dancing, having a good time. I've seen those dudes turn a Monday night into a Friday night more than once. So if you have never seen Calexico live, I highly, highly recommend you do so. Even if you don't know their music well, like, take a flyer. They're one of these bands that you go see live, even if you don't know, and you leave and you're like buying stuff at the merch table because you're saying how great it was. So if you live in Phoenix or LA or Solana Beach, California, San Francisco, Portland, Vancouver, Seattle, Salt Lake City, Boulder, Santa Fe, then you can go see Calexico in June. Highly recommend you doing so. And hey, hang out after and tell John that Chuck sent you. That'd be kind of cool. And also, as a quick follow-up, we were talking backstage, that really sweet story about his nephew selling him his cymbal. We were talking backstage about it, and I was telling Emily, and I said, how old is he anyway? And he said he's 23 or 24 years old. And I kind of laughed because I thought he was clearly like 12 or 13. And we all laughed, and I said, well, John, that story just got way less cute. He thought that was pretty funny. So big thanks to John Convertino and Joey Burns for having us after, and John for coming in here. Great conversation on Rumblefish. Go see Calexico in a city near you. And until next time, maybe go buy some drumsticks of your own and get a bucket or some pots and pans and start making some noise. Movie Crush is produced, edited, engineered, and scored by Noel Brown from our podcast studio at Pond City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.